final case this morning is Gleish against USWAC. Mr. Amiyamokri.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Goldgar. My name is Cyrus Amiyamokri. By appointment of this court, I represent the appellant, Marvin Gleish, and with me is my colleague, Darren Broden. The basic question on this appeal is what to do with a second complaint that Mr. Gleish filed after he had filed a first complaint that alleged precisely or almost precisely the same matter. This court has asked us to brief the issue from several different legal perspectives, and the one undercurrent that comes across throughout is that Mr. Gleish's circumstances don't qualify him for the kinds of sanctions that he is now being receiving as a result of the dismissals of the complaint. In other words, he is not the prototypical concern of the PLRA. And by that, let me just mention a couple of things. First, a history of abusive litigation. The record in this case shows that prior to the two complaints that Mr. Gleish had filed in this litigation, that I will simply call one litigation, Mr. Gleish had filed two civil suits, one of which had been settled, and another one that is kind of murky on the what exactly happened. It was a due process action that was dismissed. The grounds are unclear. It could count as a strike. It may not. We simply don't know. But that does not affect the analysis, as I will explain in a few minutes. But in addition, it also shows that this is not a person who frequently files lawsuits and abuses the system. A second point is that the complaints that he filed in this action, we submit, themselves were meritorious, and the allegations, particularly construed under the prevailing pleading standards in federal law, we submit stated a claim. Now, with this introduction in mind, I would like to turn to first the question that this court has asked concerning the issue of dismissals under 1915A and 1915E2B. I will essentially rest on the arguments we make in the brief. I would submit that the Ninth Circuit's reasoning in Lopez is persuasive on this point. But I would like to make one other comment.
You can't be wrong all the time.
I would like to make one other comment concerning the construction of the statute, and that is, it wasn't developed, as I was reading the brief again, it wasn't developed particularly well in the brief, and that is that 1915E2B, in contrast with 1915A, which is a pre-screening procedure, specifically refers to actions being dismissed for failure to state a claim or frivolousness or the other ground, immunity. And I just wanted to clear up that I believe that notwithstanding the difference between dismissing complaints and dismissing actions, the same reasoning would hold, because the question would be,
The question I have on that, beyond the point that sure, from a lack of an appeal we may not be able to reach it, mm-hmm, is how logically can dismissal for failure to state a claim on which relief may be granted be without prejudice? Because to say it's without prejudice implies that you can refile the same thing, and now it does state a claim on which relief may be granted. It seems almost impossible, doesn't it?
Well,
you can imagine lots of grounds for dismissal that would be, yeah, without prejudice, but that one, it's awfully, I find it hard to see.
Well, yes, except that there could be instances where technically a complaint may be lacking certain allegations, but
it could be saying you don't have to plead facts.
Well, yes, but it's a question of how take a conspiracy claim, for example. If the purpose of the conspiracy and the persons involved in the conspiracy are generally stated, but it's not really clear what the timing of the conspiracy is to give general notice to the defendant. You know, one could argue that, and we would submit this complaint should be dismissed for failure to state a claim because technically it's not even sufficient for notice pleading, but it's not so hopeless, particularly given you know, plaintiffs who may not be very well versed in the law, that it would make sense to give them at least another chance to file a complaint that would remedy that defect. And to get back to the question about the actions, just the same logic would hold, that an action can only be dismissed once a court is pretty certain that the complaint is really hopeless beyond doubt. And now I'd like to speak a little bit about the question of whether the second complaint in this case should have been construed as a Rule 60B motion. And there, just the first question would be the standard of review, and we would submit that it is an abuse of discretion, that is, and let me at the outset distinguish between two, I suppose, analytically distinct issues, one of which is when the district judge receives a paper or a pleading, how does it construe that pleading? And second, once it's taken, then how is the merits decision reached?
Well, so suppose the paper is construed as a Rule 60B motion.
Mm-hmm.
Can a Rule 60B motion be granted on the simple ground of legal error?
No, it cannot.
How does it help your client to construe it as a Rule 60B motion?
Well,
I know it's a question we told you to brief.
Yes.
So
yes.
You're not responsible for that, but still we need to figure out whether it matters.
Yeah, sure. This would be, I guess, as a practical matter, this is how I would hope that a district court would address it. But once the paper is received, and let's take these circumstances as an example. There is a certain history to this litigation. The complaint is received, and you know, given the potential consequences under 1915G, you know, it would be, I think, advisable to at least construe it as a 60B motion. And then what would happen after that, Judge Easterbrook, I think, is for the district court, because of the duty that is often mentioned by cases like Donald and others, for district courts to help pro se plaintiffs fashion their claims, I think it would be a modest extension simply to say, we're going to construe this as a 60B motion. Why don't you go back and work on it and let us know if you have legitimate grounds for a 60B post.
Is there any reason to think that your client does have legitimate grounds for relief under Rule 60B?
Well, yes. There are a number of different grounds. As you know, cases like Del Carmen and Donald state that one of the factors that is considered is the meritoriousness of the claim. And indeed, it was anticipated in cases like Metlin that if 60B relief is granted, indeed, if 60B relief is granted.
The merit of the claim might matter if you had some other ground for relief.
Sure.
But I hope you can see the problem I'm having.
Yeah.
The claim, the judge made a legal error, is not itself a ground of Rule 60B relief.
It is not. It
might be something that warrants discretion in the person's favor if there is some other ground of mm-hmm. Rule 60B relief. But that's my question.
Yes.
Is there any other ground of Rule 60B relief?
Yeah, well, the extraordinary circumstances, I would submit that the accumulation of strikes under 1915G in a situation where the claims that were actually pressed were meritorious claims, coupled with, I would submit, the district court's abuse of discretion in not giving the Mr. Gleish a chance to fashion his complaint. I mean, that was also a factor that was significant in a case like Donald's, for example. And particularly, I would emphasize the accumulation of strikes, because being it, you know, especially given that Mr. Grish is not an abuser of the system, it seems to me that these would present extraordinary circumstances that would justify relief. Mm-hmm. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Armengol. Mr. Goldar.
May it please the Court, Ben Goldgar on behalf of Attorney General Ryan. There's been a great deal of ink spilled in this case over what we believe is really quite a simple case. The key to the case is simply that Mr. Gleish filed an action which was dismissed, and then he didn't appeal. Instead, he sat for 5 months. We don't know why. And then he filed a new action. Because he didn't appeal, the judgment in the first action became res judicata, to use an old-fashioned term, and the second action was therefore barred, and so the district court was right to dismiss it, and that's really the only decision that's under review here. Mr. Gleish doesn't deny that all of the elements of claim preclusion are met. Instead, he, and we haven't heard much about this today, but I'd like to talk about it just briefly, he invokes this obscure and rarely invoked restatement exception about not applying claim preclusion where its application would frustrate a statutory objective, and he says that to do it here would frustrate the workings of the PLRA because the PLRA is only intended to bar meritless claims. That, as we pointed out, is really just an argument that the dismissal of the first action was wrong because the claim was meritorious, and to say that the first action was wrongly decided won't avoid the application of claim preclusion. Nor, we think, does it frustrate the purposes of the PLRA to dismiss, to apply claim preclusion here. The purpose of the PLRA is to prevent meritless claims, not to permit meritorious ones. And it doesn't frustrate the purpose of the statute, even if it's an unfortunate occurrence, if a meritorious claim is barred. Mr. Amir Mokri's argument and invocation of this restatement section also has some rather strange consequences. By his reasoning, prisoners could always avoid Section 1915E dismissals and the doctrine of claim preclusion simply by filing new actions and then claiming that the first action was meritorious and therefore the second action isn't barred. And it could, of course, go on and on. If that action were dismissed, then a third and fourth and so forth. And for that matter, anyone could make this argument because, of course, the purpose of Rule 12b-6 also is to dispose of meritless claims. And so, by his reasoning, claim preclusion would frustrate the workings of the federal rules as well, and we would be done with claim preclusion, and we would be done with finality.
This is a really, it's a, you know, tough case because, for me at any rate, the equities, you know, the district court made several errors here, and you've got a pro se. Bottom line, of course, the errors should have been addressed via direct appeal. But that's a sad case.
Well, and that's kind of the end of it. Well, you know, I'm not going to speak to whether the complaint stated a claim or not, given my strange position here today. I'm happy to assume that it did. Mr. Gleish had a right to appeal. He was informed of that right, and he did nothing. And he knows how to use that right if he wants to. He did it in the case that brings us here today. He has done it before in cases 89-3078 and 90-3095, and I don't know what those were about because all I have are very old docket sheets. But, you know, if Mr. Gleish knew how to file a notice of appeal 10 years ago and knew how to do it within 30 days, and one of these apparently was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, I don't know why. But he understood this, and he understood it in this case. And prisoners don't seem to have a lot of trouble with the concept that in order to get to this court, you have to file a notice of appeal and you've got to do it within 30 days. And so really the only, assuming we even have a Rule 60B issue here, which I think is a dubious assumption when we don't have a motion and we don't have any grounds in the thing that might have been construed, I suppose, as a motion. But the only thing we have outside the direct attack on the judgment is this notion that the district court should have warned Mr. Gleish that if he didn't appeal, the case was done. And there just is, this is not a situation like Lewis versus Faulkner, where we have something that's arguably required by the rules. That was what Lewis said. It was implicit in the rules that, that notice had to be given concerning Rule 56 motions. And we don't have a complex practice of the kind the courts have said Rule 56 embodies. We don't have that sort of difficulty. So we don't have a man who can say, wait a minute, you told me I could appeal, but you didn't tell me I was done if I didn't. Finally, there's this other piece of the so-called 60B calculus that we're hearing about today, and that is this risk of, that Mr. Gleish may incur three strikes. I don't think we can characterize that as an extraordinary circumstance that would involve Rule 60B. That's just the operation of the statute. And if the operation of the statute, if we can get around that with Rule 60B, then I think there are some problems with Congress's mandate here. The short answer is perhaps it was unfortunate. I won't take a stand on that. But unfortunate or not, it's just too bad. This is the way our system works. And if rules are going to be in anything, then Mr. Gleish's case is over. Therefore, we suggest that the proper course of action is for the court to affirm the judgment of the district court here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Amir Mokri, we very much appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your client and to us. We gave you a difficult set of questions, but they were dealt with very nicely. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.